ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
There was a time that admitting you were seeing a shrink or talking openly about something like suicide was utterly taboo, shameful even. And women's mental health? Well, women are just hysterical. PTSD after war? That didn't exist. That was shell shock. It was a weakness. And while stigma, shame, and misconceptions about certain conditions definitely still exist, we have undoubtedly come a long way. Not to toot our own horn, but it's why we do this show, and why so many pods on mental health and psychology have become so popular in recent years. But, and there's always a but, it seems all this talking and normalizing could be having another effect.
Probably part of the story is that we're talking more about this. That has some benefits in terms of improving mental health literacy, but it probably also tends to lead us to see everything through a psychiatric lens.
And that can affect how we see others and ourselves, because mental health labels have power. And research shows if we apply them more casually, that power can run both ways.
And what we find is, when you do experiments, those who receive the diagnostic label are seen more positively. The downside was, at the same time, they also thought that the person who had the diagnostic label was less likely to recover, was less likely to have control over their symptoms, and just generally had less agency.
So today, we revisit an episode from our archives about the power of labels and the impact of something called concept creep. From ABC Radio National, this is All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. All right, so I'll just get you to start by introducing yourself, your name, what you do, and where.
So I'm Nick Haslam. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Melbourne, where I've been for about 23 years now.
All right, so take me back in time about a decade ago. What were you starting to notice about how people were talking about mental health back then?
Well, I'd been around for quite a while. I've been doing psychology since the 80s as an undergraduate. And I think just being around so long, you start to notice how people are using words differently. And I think about a decade ago, as you said, Sana, I started to notice people using some of these psychological terms, including those to do with mental health, in a looser, broader sort of way. So I think for a long time there's been concern that maybe the idea of what a mental illness is has been stretched, and there's been a lot of critique of DSM and other diagnostic systems for apparently pathologizing a wider range of phenomena. And I think I observed that historically you can see from successive editions of the DSM how what counts as a mental illness has been broadening.
Just in case you're not familiar, the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's one of the main guides for diagnosing and categorizing mental illness.
But beyond that, just everyday people were using diagnostic concepts, for instance, more loosely to refer to more everyday experiences. People were more likely to talk about sadness as if it was depression. People were more likely to describe ordinary worries as anxiety disorders. People were more likely to start referring to ordinary life adversities, unpleasant as they might be, as traumas, whereas previously trauma had been reserved for really quite severe and extreme phenomena. So I noticed that, and at the same time I was noticing similar sorts of expansions of other harm-related concepts like bullying. You know, bullying initially had been a particular kind of peer aggression which was repeated and intentional and downward in some sort of power hierarchy. And increasingly people were using bullying, including and everyday people as well as academics, using it to refer to other kinds of sort of less severe, less intentional exclusions rather than just physical aggression, using it to refer to behavior upwards in hierarchies and sideways in hierarchies, not just downwards as initially it had been. And just generally across a whole range of concepts to do with harm and suffering, I was seeing people use words in more expansive ways. And I thought, you know, maybe there's something going on here.
There has been a lot written and said about this trend in more recent years, especially when it comes to mental illness and how terms like trauma or anxiety are perhaps being used a bit too loosely these days. But back when Nick was formulating his observations, that was less the conversation. And initially, he kept these ideas to himself.
I was just sort of noticing it, and I was noticing that maybe one would want to be careful talking about it because it's quite easy to come across as a crusty dinosaur yearning for the good old days, which really wasn't the intention. It was more just observing a pattern here. Maybe there's some sort of story you can tell about not just mental illness concepts broadening and calling it medicalization, because other people had said that before, and not just ideas of prejudice or bullying broadening and people calling that political correctness or whatever it might be, but saying, you know, maybe they're all just instances of some broader tendency or trend.
Eventually, Nick published these observations in a paper in 2016, and it's become pretty influential because in that paper, he coined the term concept creep.
There have been other people using creep to refer to the same idea of, you know, gradual stealthy change. So there's been some bracket creep in terms of taxation.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't breathtakingly original. but yeah, I think the concept was new, and it was the idea that, you know, meanings of certain concepts broaden. And I mean, this is obvious. This happens in all sorts of concepts. But I was specifically focusing on concepts to do with harm in the psychological space.
And so some of the concepts he focused on were abuse, mental disorder, prejudice, trauma, addiction, and he outlined how their meanings had crept both vertically and horizontally. So vertically to include milder versions of the behavior, and horizontally to include other contexts or behaviors, like how cyberbullying is now considered a kind of bullying, or how our understanding of trauma has expanded to include things like vicarious trauma. You can probably see how some of that creep can be helpful by naming and recognizing related harmful behaviors, but that broadening may also have unexpected effects, especially when it comes to experiences on the milder end of the spectrum. And so, about a decade after you first started looking at this, where are we now with concept creep? Has it just gotten worse?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't even say worse, because I really don't want to come across as saying this is a horrible thing. I think, you know, words naturally evolve, and we shouldn't just prejudge that broadening a concept is a bad idea. And I'm at huge pains in my work to say there are costs and benefits. But yeah, it's progressed. Whether it's good or bad, that's a matter of people's judgment. But it's increased. I mean, we do studies on this. You know, so this isn't just me in an armchair, you know, arguing with the world. This is we do studies where we look at very large bodies of text, and we track how the meaning of words changes using computational linguistic approaches. And we don't see any slowing down of this process. We do see a gradual tendency for a lot of these words to broaden their meanings.
Yeah. So can you talk about that more specifically now then? Because as you said, language changes, it evolves, it's never static. What are the costs and benefits of concept creep?
Well, in the most abstract terms, I think if you define a wider range of phenomena as involving harm, the good aspect of that is that it encourages you to do something about it. So it's essentially problematizing things that you previously tolerated. So we no longer tolerate bad behavior by bosses to the same degree as we used to. So ways of bullying, as we define it now, were previously not called bullying in the past. And because we call them bullying now, we can have grievance procedures. We can give appropriate feedback to people to stop doing what they're doing. In the mental health space, by broadening what counts as trauma, we can encourage people to take their problems seriously. We can encourage them to seek appropriate treatment. We can intervene with people who we previously would have just essentially said, you know, deal with it.
Right.
And I think in general, in an abstract term, I think if you lower the threshold for what counts as harm, you are encouraging people who experience those, if you like, milder harms, to have their problems taken seriously and to receive some sort of appropriate treatment or remedy.
Right.
The downside, of course, is that the more you tend to use these harm terms to relate to milder sort of phenomena, the more there's the risk that you'll be problematizing things which probably people could deal with themselves, or maybe which aren't quite so serious. Maybe you encourage in the mental health space people to over-medicate, or maybe you encourage people who don't necessarily need psychiatric treatment to receive it. Maybe also you trivialize those concepts. So as soon as you start using the word trauma to refer to relatively everyday adversities, you are arguably trivializing the meaning of capital T trauma, as they say. So I think, you know, there's a range of issues, a range of concerns that maybe broadening concepts of harm can make some people more fragile, can lead to some sort of overreactions and oversensitivity. And that has to be balanced against the clear advantages of broadening concepts of harm.
Yeah, the idea that it can make people more fragile. Can we dig into that a little bit? How can this lead people to be more fragile?
Well, I think if you say that a relatively sort of ordinary experience of adversity, you know, like a romantic breakup or getting a poor mark on an exam, if you start calling that a trauma, I think it leads people to really exaggerate the severity of this experience. It maybe leads them to think that they need some sort of therapeutic response. And it makes them, I think, arguably, in some cases, more keen to go after and criticize whoever they feel has done this thing to them. But I think using the language of harm to refer to things which are pretty ordinary and straightforward can lead people to think they can't cope. I mean, we actually have evidence for this in regard to sort of diagnostic concepts. If you apply a diagnostic concept like depression or anxiety to a relatively sort of mild and ordinary experience, people think you are less likely to be able to overcome that problem.
Right.
People think you're less likely to have agency in that context. People think you're less likely to recover from the problem. The moment you start using these terms a little bit promiscuously, you do run the risk of changing people's identities and changing their sense that they actually have autonomy and capacity to overcome the problems they're having.
That research that Nick is referring to was published just this year in the journal PLOS Mental Health. His team were looking specifically at the effects that diagnostic labels can have on how people perceive other people's experiences of mental ill health.
When the person is sort of right on the margins, they've got some problems, but it's not clear they rise to the level of a diagnosable condition. Because that's the analogy to concept creep. It's where you're using a label where maybe it may not belong, or maybe it may not apply. And you see what are the effects of that diagnostic label. You find they're quite mixed. So on the one hand, thankfully, those who receive the diagnostic label are seen more positively. So the person will say, I have more empathy for that person. I have more concern for that person. I think that person needs more treatment. I think that person should get extra accommodations at work or at home or at uni. So there's a kind of general positivity that goes along with the diagnostic label, quite the opposite of what you might have got, I think, 30 years ago when diagnostic labels carried a lot more stigma than they do now. So when they had the label, they at least reported that they had more empathy and more compassion for the person who was experiencing these things. So that's good and that's positive. The downside was at the same time, they also thought that the person who had the diagnostic label was less likely to recover, was less likely to have control over their symptoms, was just generally had less agency. So I think there's this upside of empathy and a downside of, but you probably will not get much better over time and you're actually in the grip of this condition rather than in control of this condition.
And just to expand on why that's troubling, what are the downstream effects of that? Like, how does that, would that continue to affect a person's psychology and how they approach the world?
We don't really know.
Okay.
Because we haven't sort of followed people through, and this is all just perceptions of hypothetical other people. This isn't actually looking at the consequences for that person. But I think a good case can be made that it would be self-fulfilling or could be self-fulfilling. If you take on board the implications of the diagnosis, which are that you have something which is deeply about you and which is maybe built into your biology, you know, over which you don't have much control, then you will make fewer attempts to overcome it. You will see yourself as more helpless in the face of this condition. So it probably is counter-therapeutic. It probably is something that will interfere with your process of recovery. At least it could. And there's a terrific English psychologist, Lucy Folkes, who's written some work on this recently in what she calls the prevalence inflation hypothesis, which argues that the increasing talk about mental illness, this increasing use of diagnostic language could be having self-fulfilling effects of that nature. So if you over-identify, is her term, if you over-diagnose yourself, that may lead you to engage in behavior which, if you like, embeds your problems further or strengthens them. So for instance, if you are someone who is a bit of a worrier, if you identify yourself as having an anxiety disorder, that might lead you to be less likely to confront threatening situations. And that avoidance will deepen your anxiety problem. So just by labeling yourself, inappropriately, you may actually create the problem that you think you had in the first place. So, you know, we don't have solid evidence that this is necessarily happening, but you can make a quite good prima facie case.
This is so interesting to me, the how much power labels have. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, why are labels so powerful? Because in some sense, you know, we have to label and categorize to understand ourselves in the world. But yeah, why does this come with such drawbacks?
Yeah, and look, I think you're spot on. I mean, labels are important. Humans love noun categories. And with diagnostic categories, for instance, they give a lot of benefit to people. So I think unless you've received some sort of psychiatric diagnosis, for instance, whether from yourself or from someone who's a professional, that entitles you to certain sort of treatments. It entitles others to see your problem as legitimate. It gives you a sense that here's a way in which I can be understood. A lot of people, when they receive a diagnosis, they say, it all becomes clear. I finally understand myself. It gives them a sort of solid footing for their identity. Mm. It often allows people to form groups. Here's my tribe. Here are the people I belong to. I can get access to resources by virtue of having this label. So I think labels have all sorts of, you know, interpersonal, social, and personal benefits. But as you say, they also contain limitations. Mm. If I'm a depressed person, if I have schizophrenia, those things define what is expected of me. You know, the stereotypes attached to those labels now attached to me and perhaps limit my capacity to define myself. Mm. So, you know, identity is, as we all know, is a bit of a double-edged sword.
Is it also true that once you adopt a label, people can, in some circumstances, start enacting that label or performing it, perhaps unconsciously?
Absolutely. And this is an idea that comes from the great Canadian philosopher Ian Hacking. He had this idea of what he called looping effects. And the idea is once you do apply a label to something, that sort of leads people to, if you like, self-fulfill the expectations of that label or perform it, and it actually changes what the label means. You know, as soon as someone is identified as belonging to a certain category, they now know how to behave. That category gives them expectations for how they ought to be, how they ought to think, how others will see them. And yeah, that can be quite powerful and hard to escape once you've actually taken that category on yourself or had other people apply it to you.
You're listening to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, the costs and benefits of concept creep. Psychology professor Nick Haslam from the University of Melbourne coined that term, concept creep, and it refers to the way certain harm-related labels, like trauma or bullying, for example, are being used in an ever-expanding variety of situations. Their meaning and application has morphed. And if you want to go by the most ungenerous stereotype, you might think it's all keyboard warriors and Gen Z types that are driving this change. But is that totally true? Well, as part of his research, Nick has also analyzed which groups hold broad versus narrow definitions of mental illness.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think younger people are, there's a lot of really good evidence that younger people are experiencing more mental ill health, and that's not really a new thing. That's been the reality for quite a long time. Being young is challenging. I think there's also a lot of good evidence that the rates of mental ill health among young people have been rising more steeply than those for others. But what we do find in this study, which we published recently, is that young people self-diagnose more, and part of the reason why they self-diagnose more is because they have broader concepts of mental illness than older people. That's not the entirety of the effect. It's not saying the only reason why young people ascribe themselves more mental illness is because they have broad concepts of what mental illness is, but it is part of the story. Mm-hmm. So we very often find young people have broader concepts, and it's not just because they're more enlightened and more knowledgeable, it's also because they just have a lower threshold for applying mental illness concepts. We often find politically progressive people have broader concepts. Sometimes we find women have broader concepts. So, you know, I think this is the reality that even though we're all using the same words, we're often using them with quite different meanings and to refer to quite different range of phenomena.
So is it better to have a narrower understanding of mental illness rather than broader?
Not necessarily. So I think, again, if it was real, just imagine if it was really narrow. Let's say if you were teleported back to 100 years ago, where the only kind of mental illness that we recognized essentially was psychosis, was madness. You know, before we started adding all of these sort of so-called milder issues of anxiety and depression and eating and sleeping and that whole range. If you had a really narrow concept like that, you wouldn't seek help if you were depressed. You wouldn't seek help if you were suffering things which we have effective treatments for. So right. That would be tragic. Having an overly narrow concept is no solution either. No, I'm not in any way saying that we need to scale everything back. I'm just saying that there is a historical trend where the breadth of these concepts is expanding, and that does have some downsides.
And what do you pin the cause of that trend to? Is it social media? Is it the DSM, which is, you know, often changing? Why is this happening?
Really good question. And I don't have the answer, sadly. but I think it's a few things. It's very fashionable, I think, to blame the DSM for pretty much everything. And look, the DSM certainly has expanded what it counts as a mental illness. So when it started in the first edition was 1952, it had about 100 conditions, and now it's got 300 or 400. And it's added whole, you know, ranges of conditions that previously weren't considered, you know, medically relevant. They weren't considered part of psychiatry. So undeniably, psychiatry through the DSM and other classification systems has colonized a wider range of human experiences. So it's part of the story. But I think as of the last decade or so, actually, it's everyday people who are doing the expansion, not DSM. We've done a study of this again. Sorry to blow my own horn here. But we've sort of looked at whether there's any evidence that the diagnostic thresholds in DSM have tended to lower over the last few decades, and they actually haven't on average. For some, they have. So for ADHD, they certainly have. For autism, they have, but then it's sort of tightened up again in the last edition. So for some conditions, there's been a diagnostic expansion, but overall, no, DSM is not inflating. It's not lowering the threshold. So I think we can't blame DSM for this. We can probably blame it for a lot of other things.
So can we blame social media then?
I don't think we can blame social media. I think we can certainly blame social media for some things. So in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, certainly there's been some very expansive misinformation about conditions like Tourette's and other things. And I think that is encouraging some people, especially those who get, you know, trapped in the algorithm of TikTok and led down this path. But I don't think that's the main thing, because a lot of the attention to mental health and illness over time predates social media. There's been this rise that we see in our studies of the amount of attention paid to matters psychiatric since the 80s, long before there was social media. So it's, you know, we're a bit myopic. We only look at what's going on in the recent past, but a lot of these trends go back a whole lot longer. I think it's more that there's been a general rise in two things which are correlated. One is there's been a rising attention to harm and sensitivity to harm. There's been a sort of gradual enlightenment about the presence of harm. We've become more sensitized to it, and that's been going on since at least 1980 or so. And mental illness is just one form of harm. So I think we've just become more and more willing to talk about these things, less and less tolerant of harms we previously tolerated. And a lot of what we're seeing in this space for concept creep, not just for mental health concepts, but concepts of harm in general, goes back about 4 or 5 decades rather than just social media. And I think also my people are at fault here, the psychologists and psychiatrists. It's been very, very successful in terms of attracting cultural attention. We talk vastly more about mental illness and mental health than we used to. And most people, I think, these days say that's an entirely positive thing. That's wonderful that we're talking more about it. But I think the downside of it as well is that the more you talk about something, the more the meaning of those concepts tends to spread. And we find again in our research that what drives the broadening of these concepts of mental ill health is just how much people talk about them. So I think probably part of the story, again, sorry for the long-winded answer is that we're talking more about this. That has some benefits in terms of improving mental health literacy, but it probably also tends to lead us to see everything through a psychiatric lens.
This is so tricky. I think a lot of people might struggle with that idea that, you know, talking about something can make it worse in some ways, because not talking about the stuff we were going through is what kept so much shrouded in shame for so long. But then there's also this flip side you're talking about. So for like the average person listening to this conversation thinking, wait, what the hell do I do? Do I talk about my issues? Do I not talk about them? What would you say about how they should think about all this, given what you're saying and what the research has shown about the power of labels and all the rest?
Yeah, look, I think it's tricky. I don't have really helpful advice, I'm sorry, to all your listeners. But I do think, you know, it's not compulsory to talk about suffering exclusively through a diagnostic or a psychiatric lens. A lot of suffering is not reducible in that way. Often it's not the best way to refer to the troubles you're having using some DSM diagnosis.
Right.
So I think sometimes it is useful. These concepts don't come out of nowhere. They do capture, you know, real sets of attributes people have, and they are linked to some degree to effective treatments, but they're not the only way to think. And I think we just need to sort of think twice about applying psychiatric labels to our experience. That doesn't mean it's never appropriate. It just means it shouldn't always be the first thing you go to. And I think we should also just be a little bit, you know, have a bit of more hygiene about how we use some terms. I think the overuse of trauma, I think, is quite troubling, and I think it does have some real impact. So let's just think twice before we call a bad hair day a trauma.
Fair enough. Do you think we'll eventually need to come up with new words to describe, for example, like capital T trauma, you know, if people start using it for bad hair days more and more, and that's kind of where it lands? Well, we need new words to separate the really serious stuff from the benign.
We might, but there's always going to be a tendency to, you know, try to use the more serious word if it can apply, because you'll get more cred for doing it and you'll get more attention. I think the moment you start calling certain things small t trauma, people get upset because it's thinking, are you trivializing my experience? My experience is a real trauma, and it's...
If you're not familiar with that kind of newer language, big T trauma is basically the original trauma. It's the kind you might get from a really terrible, often life-threatening event, like a terrorist attack or sexual assault or a car accident. Small T trauma refers not to a bad hair day, but to what you might experience from events like a horrible divorce or legal troubles or financial issues. These events are still deeply emotionally distressing, but they're not inherently life-threatening.
So I think... Yeah, people are already, I think, using the big T versus small t, and it's not really a great solution, is it? I think a better solution would be to just have some sort of limits about what the word really means. Yeah, and what the alternative language would be, I don't really know. I think probably we already have some words out there which would do the trick, you know, like adversity or like stress. You know, there are some words which don't have quite the same oomph attached to them, which you could use, which would be equally descriptive, but maybe not quite as rhetorically effective.
Right. My bad hair day is an adversity rather than a trauma.
Probably not even an adversity.
Yeah, probably not. Right. It's just a bad hair day. That's what it is.
Yeah. So look, I think I'm not the language police, and I'm not saying how people ought to change their language.
Yeah, that is the trick, right? You end up being seen as the language police.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not really what I'm intending to do. I'm just a neutral academic trying to get published. But yeah, you know, I think there's a widespread belief that some of these words are being used a bit too loosely, and maybe there'll be some pendulum swing back in some ways in future. Who knows?
Yeah. Where do you think this conversation is headed in the next 10 years? Do you think we'll pull back from the creep at some point because people will, you know, more widely come to understand the drawbacks of concept creep, or will we keep charging full throttle ahead?
Well, it's hard to see how we could keep charging full throttle ahead because without the language becoming meaningless. But look, I suspect there'll be some sort of pullback. There's already more and more people now talking about these ideas and maybe saying, you know, maybe this has gone a little bit too far. There's more voices saying that now than there were 5 years ago. For instance, in the mental health space, who are saying maybe all of these campaigns are actually doing some harm, not only doing good. Maybe we need to be a bit more thoughtful about how we try to spread the word about mental illness in a way that doesn't inadvertently increase it. You know, maybe we should pull back a little bit from constant talk about distress and mental ill health. You know, maybe it's actually not so beneficial. So I suspect there'll be some sort of gentle pullback, but it's very hard to predict the future like that, isn't it? And I think it'll also vary very much according to different concepts. This doesn't all happen at once. Different concepts broaden and contract at different times. And I think this will have to be a battle that's fought on lots of different fronts.
That is Professor of Psychology from the University of Melbourne, Nick Haslam. He's the guy who coined the term concept creep. And that is it for All in the Mind this week. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr and senior producer James Bullen. I'm Sana Qadar. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.